All right, good morning. Wednesday morning Bible study, The Art of Dying. I think we are on week 9 this week. We finished the book called Art of Dying last week. And so this week we're going to go through Christian Care at Life's End. So this booklet, you'll see, all of you have a copy?
Yes.
You'll see it was written by our church body, the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, dated February 1993. So this was to give guidance to pastors and congregations and to members about issues that happen near the end of life, okay? Problems that happen near the end of life. And how, what is theologically and ethically acceptable or not? So that's part of what's going on here. Now I want you to remember, think back to the mid-90s. What was going on back then? You'll remember as we get into this a little bit, and I'm just going to skim some highlights through here. That was the era when our nation was going through a great debate about assisted suicide. Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Remember that? This booklet was written in the midst of that debate, so keep that in mind, okay? So, let's dive in. So if you turn to the opening page there, you'll see the topics. At Life's End, Christian Care or Mercy Killing. That's the thing that it's talking about there. Laura, do you need a copy of this?
I'll share it.
Okay. I can get some more from Christy, and she can print them lickety-split right after the class. Didn't realize we'd run out. All right, that's good. Advanced Directives. So Angela's going to touch on Advanced Directives a little bit in her presentation. Spiritual Care at Life's End of Life Decisions and Justification by Grace, and the Christian Community's Responsibilities in Public Debate. So this is kind of the starter booklet from our church, and then next week that other booklet was written about a decade ago, I forgot the date, 2009 or something, and that will also give further information that dovetails with this booklet, okay? So turn the page, page 4, I'm going to touch on some of these principles. Principle 1, euthanasia in its proper sense is a synonym for mercy killing, which involves suicide and or murder. It is therefore contrary to God's law. Our church and most other Christian churches recognize that assisted suicide is a sin. It's against God's will. Our God is a God of life. And so euthanasia, if you use the synonym mercy killing, you're helping someone to kill themselves, or you are being active in killing them because they don't want to live anymore, maybe due to some illness or depression or pain or whatever. But nevertheless, in all of its forms, it's contrary to God's law. Okay? Principle 2. As creator, God alone knows with certainty whether a disease or an injury is incurable. So we would often say, you know, the situations, and this was the case back in the 90s when this was going on, is that somebody has a terminal illness and there's no hope for them to recover, and so I just want to kill myself. I want to call up Dr. Jack Kevorkian and have him hook me up to the stuff, and, you know, I just want to die. I want to kill myself. Well, I know Pastor Q has told stories. You hear it from other pastors as well. Somebody has a terminal illness, and then all of a sudden they go in for a scan, and the doctors are flabbergasted. Oh, it's gone. We don't know what happened. Well, we as Christians know what happened.
A miracle.
A miracle from God.
Yes.
Now, that doesn't happen often. You know, maybe just a handful of percentages of cases. But it does occasionally happen. God can intervene in miraculous ways. So for us to say, this disease is the end and I just want to kill myself, you don't know that. Nobody does. It's up to God. God alone knows. Okay, principle 3. When the God-given powers of the body to sustain its own life can no longer function, and doctors in their professional judgment conclude that there is no real hope for recovery, even with life support instruments, a Christian may, in good conscience, let nature take its course. Rather than saying, let nature take its course, I wish they had said, let God be in control. Something like that. But this is a case where it is not euthanasia or assisted suicide to just remove somebody from artificial life support. Okay? That is allowing God to have his will with a person. It might be a case that somebody is on a ventilator, on a heart machine, whatever, and you're keeping them alive beyond God's will. God's will might be actually, he's ready to take this person home to heaven, and we're preventing that. And taking somebody off of a life support machine is not necessarily a death sentence. Again, Pastor Q tells a story, and I think it was somebody here in our congregation decades ago. They were taken off of life support, and then they kind of recovered a little bit, and they regained consciousness, and they lived for another year or two. Mm-hmm. I don't remember who it was. Probably most of you would remember, but I remember him telling that story. On the other hand, I can tell you in my time as a chaplain at Lutheran Hospital down in Fort Wayne, there was one time that the family had decided to take somebody off of life support. They were on a ventilator, and they called for the chaplain. I was on duty, so I went. And they turned off the ventilator and removed it with the family there, and I was there with the family. I don't recall if they were Lutheran or not, but they were Christian, so they had asked me to pray with them, and I did. And the person died, like, within 5 minutes. So that often happens too. But to keep somebody on life support, when the doctors say there's nothing left, it's not doing any good, it is okay. Ethically, it's acceptable to say, we're just going to turn off the machines and let God do what he wants to do. Okay? All right, that's principle number three. Principle number four, administering pain-killing medications, even at the risk of shortening life, is permissible since this does not entail the choice of death as either a means or an end. So if somebody is in pain, suffering, and there's a particular pain medication or pain treatment that would help alleviate that suffering, but the doctors say, by giving this pain medication, we may shorten their expected lifespan from 9 months down to 6 months, or some such scenario. We would say that's still okay, ethically, to provide that pain medication. You're not doing it with the purpose of trying to hasten death. You're rather doing it for the purpose of alleviating suffering. There's a difference, and God knows, okay? You understand? All right, so there's the first four principles. Before I continue, any questions, any thoughts or comments?
Could you say that one more time, this part where you say you're relieving pain, not inducing death?
Sure. If there's a pain medication that the doctors say that this would help reduce the pain or the suffering that a person is incurring, however, due to the nature of this medication, it would shorten their expected life. So if they say, you know, you're expected to live another 9 to 12 months, but if you take this pain medication, it's going to shorten your expected lifespan to 6 to 9 months. You say, well, somebody could argue the point and say, well, that's like assisted suicide. You're hastening death. And we would say, no, that's not the case here. You're alleviating suffering, not the intention of hastening death. Even though that may be an after effect, that giving this pain medication may make death come sooner than it would have otherwise. Okay? Does that help?
Sounds tough. Call there.
It's a very tough call. Absolutely. And next week we're going to get into even more scenarios, and I'm going to provide you with like some cases of, examples of this or that. And there is absolutely a middle area where I would say, even as pastors, theologians, as a church, we would say, I'm not sure. Is this the right decision or is that the right decision? I'm not sure. We're going to cover some of those next week, okay? All right. Then in your booklet here, there's a number of pages here where they give some case examples and some description. I'm going to skip that. You can read that at your own if you want. If you start flipping through, let's see, let's get to the next section. There's a whole bunch of cases there. Wow. All the way up to page 16. Page 16, advanced directives. Principle number five. It is good ethical procedure for the doctor to request and receive a statement signed by the patient, if competent to consent, or by the nearest of kin, agreeing to the uselessness of further heroic efforts and consenting to termination of treatments. I think that principle was written in here by this church commission for Christian doctors, that doctors should not take it upon themselves to say, well, this is what we're going to do. You do what you do is at the consent of the patient or their family. And hence, we would say it is a good practice to have advance directives. And Angela's got a stack of them up here, you know, kinds of some generic forms. She gave some out last night. Thank you for bringing more so everybody can have one. And she'll touch on that a little bit during her presentation. But yes, it's a good thing to have an advance directive and let your family know what your desires are and maybe some of the scenarios in which you would want resuscitation or not want resuscitation. That's the biggest one, right? A DNR, do not resuscitate. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, and if you want that under certain circumstances, but not under other circumstances. So you can have those kinds of things documented. That's what an advance directive does. All right, page 17, principle 6. Each person, no matter how infirm or socially useless he or she may appear to be, deserves to be accepted as being created in the image of God. Did God create all of us in His image?
Yes.
Yes. Is our God a God of life?
Yes.
Yes. He never intended death. Death is the result of our sin. God never intended death. And frankly, nobody is ever socially useless. That's a horrible phrase. Okay? Now, there's lots of reasons why somebody might be going through suffering. You guys know this. I've said this multiple times in other Bible studies, including this one as well. So I'll reiterate it again. One of those is principle 7. While suffering is an intrusion into life, it provides the opportunity for Christian witness and service. Well, Pastor, just look at my state. I can't even get out of bed without help. And look at, you know, I've got all these problems and I, you know, this infirmity and I just need help with everything. I have no purpose in life. Why can't I just die now? Well, I don't know. It's up to God, first of all. We don't hasten death. We don't actively pursue death. However, I would contradict somebody's idea that I'm useless or I have nothing to do in life. No, that's not true. Why does God allow suffering? One reason is to strengthen you in faith. Another reason is to maybe enliven your prayer life. Well, Pastor, what can I do? All I do is lay in bed all day. Well, you can pray for me. I need prayers. That usually gets them to smile, at least, or kind of chuckle a little bit. Pray for your church. Pray for your family. We need more prayer warriors, don't we? No matter what your state of life, you can pray. There's a purpose. You can witness, principle 7. You can witness to your caregivers through your attitude, through your thankfulness or gratitude for their help. That's a witness, a Christian witness, pointing to Jesus. You can pray for your family. You know, how many of us have family members who have kind of drifted away from God or the church? So there are purposes that God has for you, even in a state of suffering. Okay? Principle 8. Often the time prior to death is so wrapped in mystery that no one ought forcibly to interrupt the movement of a man's spirit, as it may be communicating through God's spirit with his creator and redeemer, by way of responding in trust and inner yearning. That moment of death, nobody knows what that moment is like. Well, except for Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe those handful that were raised from the dead, Lazarus and the widow's son at Nain and Jairus' daughter. But no one other than just those few exceptions has come back from the dead. So we don't know what happens at that moment of death. It's mysterious. It really is. It's a mystery. Now, for us Christians, it's not necessarily a scary mystery because we know where we're going. We know what's coming. We know Jesus has redeemed us and we know heaven awaits. So it's still mysterious, although it's hopefully not scary. It's more a matter of comfort. And you guys have heard stories of people who have been you know, the classic one, on the operating table, and they die for a moment, and then they see themselves kind of floating, and they have this sense of peace, and then all of a sudden they're resuscitated, and they're back in their body, and they have that Homer Simpson moment, don't, I'm back, I was on my way to heaven, I could sense it. I don't know if those are true or not, I kind of think they probably are, those stories. But that's part of the mystery of that moment of death. We really don't know. And it's not for us to interrupt that. Okay? So we shouldn't be artificially keeping someone alive against God's will. So that's part of that too. Alright, principle 9. Death is not merely a physical, but a crucial spiritual event for each person. Yes, it is. We were just talking about that a little bit as well. Okay, let's go on. Turn the pages. Let's see, all the way to page 21. End of life decisions and justification by grace. Principle 10. Any decisions made in this highly complex area and any actions taken that may later appear to have been wrong have been redeemed by that forgiveness which is available to all who put their trust in the work and merits of mankind's Savior and Redeemer, Jesus. So in other words, this is saying, if at the time, in the moment, and these medical conditions are so complex and so varied, and medical technology is advancing so quickly that new opportunities or options are available. So you make a decision on behalf of a loved one or yourself, and then sometime later you think, oh, we shouldn't have made that decision. We should have done this instead. Well, guess what? God forgives. There is forgiveness. You make the best decision that you think you can according to God's will at that moment. And if it turns out that it appears in the future like it might have been the wrong decision, God forgives. There's forgiveness in all those situations. Okay? All right, turn the page. 22. Principle 11. The spiritual and moral questions raised by the issue of euthanasia are of such a nature that their evaluation is an enterprise touching on the very survival of the basic principles which undergird the integrity of our Christian faith and the survival of our cultural heritage. They constitute the primary spiritual and moral crucible of this age. I absolutely think that's true. I'm glad that the whole debate about assisted suicide has sort of died down, although I think it's probably still legal in Oregon or someplace. I'm not sure. But the idea that assisted suicide should become commonplace degrades life. It devalues the blessing of life itself. And it focuses us on death. That's not God's will. God doesn't desire death, but, you know, because of sin, we have to go through it. But God would uphold us as wanting to promote and as much as possible to maintain life. Okay? Our God is a God of life. Principle 12. Christians are obligated to make their position known by whatever means possible as a way of helping to shape public opinion on the question of euthanasia. So that was basically saying, this is back in the time of Jack Kevorkian, that we as a church body should speak up in the public square and say that, no, this is not right. Frankly, we should do that on lots of topics. And one that we often do that on is abortion, of course. You know, abortion, life begins at conception. We speak up on that a lot. Okay, questions or comments? Pause again while I need some coffee. Yeah, Ellen.
You know, the way human beings push things to the extreme, I could just see some person who shot someone saying that he was just assisting him in his suicide.
Yeah, boy, that would be quite an excuse, wouldn't it? Yeah. Well, they wanted to die anyway. I just shot him because they wanted to die.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't heard that yet, but now you've jinxed it. So we're going to have to hear that pretty soon, right? Yeah, the twisted logic of some parts of our culture is just amazing. All right, go to page 26. So you can read kind of the in-between, the case studies, the rest of that. Now here it says a Bible study. Again, we're not going to go through this whole Bible study. I don't have time. I'm running out of time. But I want to hit a few highlights here. So part one, always to care. Always to care. You guys know the Hippocratic Oath, right? What is the Hippocratic Oath? Anyone? Can anyone voice it for us?
Do no harm.
Yes. And that's an oath supposedly that medical people take, right? I hope they still take it, but I'm not sure. The whole idea of assisted suicide goes against the Hippocratic Oath. Part of the reason why we would say as a church body, it morally undermines our culture because now it forces doctors to not just think about preserving life, but also making decisions as to when to end life. And that should not be on the mind of a doctor. Okay? So yes, there's the Hippocratic Oath. I hope it's still in vogue, but I don't know. But it also applies to us. Here it is, points 1, 2, and 3. You see it right there. 1, caring by attempting to alleviate suffering. Suffering is a result of sin. Should we try to alleviate someone's suffering? Yes. If that means, you know, fluffing their pillow or bringing them a glass of water, or if that means recommending some pain medication or fetching it, even if the pain medication were to possibly shorten their life, we try to alleviate suffering. Suffering is from sin, and we fight against that. Point number 2, caring by attempting to explain suffering. That helps somebody who's going through suffering. Now, we can't always explain it, but often we can. First of all, the source of suffering is not God. It is sin, the devil, and ourselves. Secondly, how do we explain suffering? By saying God has a purpose in it. We've already mentioned this. You could be witnessing to your caregivers. You could be praying. You could be being strengthened in faith by God and other purposes as well. So we can try to explain suffering, even though sometimes we can't. But sometimes we can. Point 3 there, caring by being present with one who suffers. When I was a chaplain at the Lutheran Hospital, we went through a class called Clinical Pastoral Education, CPE. It's known by caregivers in hospitals. And I got one credit, so I have one credit under my belt. One of the things we talked about in that class was the ministry of presence. Just being with somebody. You know, when somebody's sick, you don't really necessarily have to be doing anything but just being there. Holding their hand, talking to them. Like in my case, I don't know what to do. I'm not medical. But what do? I pray with them. Or read scripture. It's just a ministry of presence. You know what? That helps a lot. Somebody who is suffering. Just to be there. And all of you can do that for each other. All right? That's tremendous. All right, there's some scripture passages and hymns and things all about that. Turn the page. Page 28. Part 2, Never to Kill. In the document discussion of Principles 1 and 2 in Part 1 asserts that Christians never aim at death as a solution to the problems of dying. I think that is absolutely true for us. It's a Hippocratic Oath for us as non-medical people. Do nothing that promotes death. Taking away a life-preserving machine that is artificially keeping someone alive is not promoting death. But to do something that promotes death is against our God's intention for us. Okay? Then one that I want to bring up, because I have actually had this question of me. The bottom of page 28, the last bullet point. Some people object that if God's word permits the government to take life in punishment of certain crimes, that seems to contradict the principle that only God is the Lord of life and death. Read Romans 13. St. Paul says that through the government, God's wrath against crime is being carried out. But is there any passage in God's word that would, in a similar way, say that God has appointed to certain persons the task of ending lives through mercy killing? Yes, God has established, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the death penalty for certain crimes. Now, that doesn't mean we have to enact the death penalty. The state of Michigan did away with the death penalty quite a while ago, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody know how long? I don't know.
It's over 100 years, I think.
Oh, it's been that long?
I think
so. I thought it was more like 40 or 50 years, it seems. Well. I don't know. Anyway, Michigan does not have the death penalty. That's okay. We don't have to do it just because God does prescribe it in Scripture, but it is allowable. Many states do have the death penalty for certain heinous crimes. That is an entirely different matter than mercy killing or assisted suicide. God does not address mercy killing or assisted suicide in Scripture. That is not something we should be engaged in. They are two different topics. Okay? So for somebody to equate the two would be a misunderstanding of God's Word. All right? With me? All right. Let's see. I think we're about near the end. Page 30, part 3, not to prolong dying. Look at the number one resource there, in the middle, right in the middle of page 30. Read Luke chapter 2. Discuss Simeon's prayer now to depart in peace. Simeon, we hear about this at Christmas time, right? He was a faithful priest in the temple, and God had given him a vision or a dream that he would see the Messiah before he died. Joseph and Mary brought the baby Jesus to be presented at the temple, and God revealed to him, Simeon realized, this is the Messiah. And so he said, all right, thank you, God. What a blessing that is. I'm now ready to die. Now, did Simeon actively pursue death? No. But he said, I'm ready. I'm ready, God. Take me home. He's ready. I've had lots of shut-ins say that to me. Pastor, I'm ready. Why isn't God taking me home? And you know, one of my jokes is, you guys have heard this before. Sorry, I'm using my same jokes over and over again. Am I starting to turn into Pastor Q?
Yeah.
One of my jokes is, well, God hasn't finished painting your room in the mansions yet. So he's not ready to take you home yet. You just got to be patient a little bit longer. God will take you home when he's ready. And that's very true. Okay? So we can be like Simeon and say, God, I'm ready. But we don't actively pursue death on behalf of ourselves or a loved one. Okay? All right. I think that's about the end here.
Pastor?
Yeah?
Doesn't God really have something more for you to do if he isn't taking you to death?
Well, that is possible. God might have something more for you to do if he hasn't yet taken you home.
Jeremiah 29:11?
Yes.
Plans for you?
Yes, I have plans for you. And one of the most obvious plans is for you to pray for other people. You know, to be a prayer warrior. Which anyone can do no matter your state of suffering or infirmity. So, yes, God has something for you to do since he hasn't called you home yet. Very true. Yeah. Go ahead, Ann.
It's probably not just for that individual, but the people who surround that individual. My grandmother lived to 90. She lived to 90. And she had dementia. And it was not good, you know, at the end. And so her purpose was not so much in what she was still able to do, but her purpose was more in the people caring for her and her family.
Sure. And it could be, too, that somebody is at the point of, a terminal illness. You can see death is coming and they're lingering, and what is the reason? Well, maybe there's some family members that want to have the chance to say goodbye. Now, it's not necessary to do that, but that's a good thing. So it might be for the people around you. So that could be a purpose as well. That's true. Okay, page 32, part 4, advanced directives. I'm not going to cover this here. Angelo's going to cover a little bit of that there, and then we're into the appendix. So that's a good skim through of this booklet, okay? Since we ran out, I'm going to have Christy print another half a dozen or so. These are just printed off on the computer. So I'll have them after class if some of you are sharing or whatever. So I'll have those available. So let me invite up Angela from hospice. It used to be called Caring Circle. I found out last night, but now it's called something else, Hospice and Palliative Care and Community Support from Corwell Health. All right. So Angela's going to talk to us about this. Did everybody get one of the handouts of her presentation?
No.
It looks like this. Okay. So this is the slide she has on the PowerPoint, so you can follow along if you want. Now, I'm going to tell you, last night she needed about 35 minutes. I'm past time. I intended to be half an hour. You see the time.
Okay.
So, let's say, you know, just plan on she's going to go probably till about 22 or quarter two, okay?
Oh,
so
okay.
She has enough time.
Depends on how many.
You know. Depends on how many questions there are.
I'll stay as long as you would like me to.
All right. All right. So, thank you, Angela.
Thank you. So, I really consider this a privilege to be here. I just want to tell you a little bit about my background and why I do this work. So about 15 years ago, my mother, she was 68 years old, working full-time, very vibrant woman on the East Coast. She had a heart attack and ended up in the hospital. And then as a result of that, her kidney shut down. So she ended up on dialysis for like 8 years. And during that time, she had several very serious things happen. And she had a team of specialists and doctors whose mission was to keep her alive and to keep sustaining her. And there was a lot of suffering that went along with that. There was nobody who ever suggested do hospice care or do palliative care to relieve that pain and suffering. And I didn't know anything. I didn't know at the time. Even though I worked in the medical field, I worked at South Haven Hospital, I thought that a doctor had to make all these suggestions. And often, they're not making those suggestions, so you have to advocate for yourself and your loved ones. So my mission, pretty much. So the end of her life really broke our family apart because there was an agreement on a lot of things, and I think it could have all been avoided had the hospice conversation been brought up and the fear of hospice not be there. And I think that it's a word, I can clear a room sometimes. If I say, I'm going to talk about hospice, the whole room will leave, you know. So it's the H word. But I guess my hope is that I can give you some information that makes you comfortable with knowing that along with everything that he was speaking about, that's really what hospice is about, alleviate suffering, be there with families, help families support and, you know, have ministry of presence with our loved ones. So please interrupt me any time that you would like to ask a question or have a comment. So as a background, too, so in 1983, Congress enacted the hospice benefit. So it's paid for by Medicare, and then most other insurances pay for it as well. We were one of the first hospices in the state of Michigan. We're the 11th hospice, actually. And before it was a benefit that anyone got paid any money for, we did it all on a volunteer basis. And there are many different hospices. We're still a nonprofit hospice, so we're not trying to make any money. In fact, we, you know, need the support of the bigger hospital system to pay payroll and things like that. So it's just important to know that, and just know that it's available to everyone if it's necessary, and that you just need to call us. So that's my goal. Anyway, we were called Hospice at Home for like 35 years. I think people know that name in the community. And then it changed to Caring Circle when I started 8 years ago. And now, since we have been a part of Lakeland since 2007, but now that Lakeland's a part of Corewell Health, now we're called Corewell Health Hospice and Palliative Care. So that's what it is. I know. I was like, I liked Caring Circle better, but then people would say to me, if I'm looking for hospice, I'm looking at the word Caring Circle, I don't know what that means. If a doctor says we need hospice, I'm looking for the word hospice. So I don't know. Can't wait either way. So anyway, we say that it's really the single most important thing you can do if there's somebody who's been, you know, diagnosed with a life-limiting illness. And then we are a team of professionals that are highly trained in providing that level of care. And our goal is always comfort and no pain as much as possible. And we look at the whole person, just, you know, physically, spiritually, emotionally. And that is the quality of life for not just the individual, but all their loved ones as well. And so we really spend a lot of time educating families, supporting families. We have social workers and counselors that really just help the family understand everything their loved one is going through and how they can support them. So, and it's available to anyone in the community regardless of an ability to pay. As a nonprofit, that's our mission. And so, although Medicare will pay for it, there's also some insurances that maybe someone doesn't have Medicare, they have they're in a younger person, because we do get younger people, who their insurance doesn't pay for the whole thing. We have benevolent funds that we have so that people don't have to worry about that if that's a concern. So that's the goal, you know, so that it's there. And so it's really for supporting people in the last phases of a life-limiting illness. And I think it's similar to what we were talking about in the booklet, that we recognize dying as a part of the normal process of living. You know, you may go through your whole life never speak, never having cataract surgery or never having a hip replacement or, you know, maybe never needing certain oral surgeries or whatever, but we're all ultimately going to face this. This is just going to happen. So really our focus is the quality of that experience and how that goes. And then we are really, and I think that especially during COVID, a lot of the health system was looking at the way we do work, because our work is very person-centered. So we're always to the family and the individual, what is important to you? What are your goals? What, you know, what matters to you? And we're working around all of that with the family. So we have an interdisciplinary team care, which means just a team of professionals, which I have on the next slide, that all get together and talk about every aspect of what's going on with the family and with the person, and identifying all the ways they might need support and offering all of that support. So if someone is in hospice care, whatever their diagnosis is that brought them to hospice care, all of their medications will be paid for, all of their medical equipment, the hospital beds, whatever, all of the supplies, we have volunteers, and then some additional grief support that I'll talk to you about as well. Just, I talk a lot, so you can stop me anytime you want, and I can talk till tomorrow, but... and then additional services. So we have, you know, right down the road, we have a residential facility where someone can get Hanson Hospice Center, where if there was a patient that we were caring for in their home and their symptoms were really getting out of control, we have the option of bringing them there to provide continuous round-the-clock nursing support as well as social workers and all the team. Or we can bring them to a hospital or a skilled nursing facility that we have a contract with. But so we, you know, we really prefer to bring people to the Hanson Center. It's a beautiful facility. It's amazing. And so we also provide hospice care in the hospital. The doctors, sometimes a patient may be in the hospital and they're really declining and it doesn't look like they're going to be physically able to leave the hospital, the doctors will call us to come in and provide that higher level of pain control and symptom management and family support. So they really look for us for those situations. We, you know, we'll go wherever we got to go. And then we offer complementary therapies, like we have a massage therapist and who will, you know, provide that comfort to a patient if they would like. And then we do a lot of caregiver training. Like one of the things we do is that, you know, we can't be there 24/7, but you can call us 24/7. We can't be there round the clock. But we will give a family a booklet that will really explain, like, if they have this, this is the medication you might have on hand. This is the symptom it could help with. We even give out a booklet, and then the social workers spend a lot of time educating the family about when the time comes. What are the different things that you might be seeing or experiencing? But also, people don't have to read the book. They can just call us and talk to our nurses and tell them what's going on. And if necessary, we'll send a nurse out, you know, 3 in the morning, whatever is needed. We don't ever, we're available to you round the clock. And then community bereavement services. So I'll talk a little about that. So this is the team. We have a patient and family in the center. That's all the team is going to surround that patient and that family. So we have doctors, we have mid-level providers, which are nurse practitioners or physician assistants. We have nurses. It's Nurses Week, by the way, so if you see a nurse or you know a nurse, thank them. And especially hospice nurses, I have such respect for them because I listen to what they go through and how they show up. I mentioned last night we have after-hours nurses that usually are called for a crisis at in the middle of the night, and they are right there at the family, you know, walking into maybe a neighborhood they've never been. They're our special after-hour ones. So I really honor those folks very much. And then we have social workers, so they will help guide a family however, whatever's needed. We, you know, work a lot with veterans and make sure that if someone is a veteran and their condition is related to their service, that is well documented, so at the time of their passing, their loved one gets all the benefits that they're entitled to because their condition was service related, and that's really important to us. So we, again, the social workers work on that. They also help families, like if somebody's working and their mother is going through hospice and they're having trouble getting, you know, leave of absence from work, you know, they'll advocate for them. Our social workers also work with a ton of community agencies like the Area Agency on Aging and PACE, and so we really have a guardianship organization. So they really have great relationships. Do you have a question? See my question? And then we have a spiritual care bereavement counselor. So it's non-denominational, but we have people who, their team, they are a team, the spiritual care team, and they'll go in and do ministry of presence as well as whatever an individual wants. And a lot of times, they are just someone to sit and talk with somebody just about what they're going through. And they also work with, we have home health aides that will come and provide that bathing support, whatever is needed for vegetation care. And then we have volunteers, so we're always looking for volunteers. I mentioned that. When hospice started and that Congress signed it into law, they said that if you're a hospice agency, 5% of the care you do must be done by volunteers, because they felt like volunteerism was the heart of hospice, and they wanted to keep it that way intentionally. So every week, this whole team, we have this three times a week because there's three different deans. We'll talk about families that are coming up or a patient that we're reviewing, and every person will have something to say about what they're experiencing, about what's going on with the patient, what's going on with the family, how can we support them, what else is needed. So they all have a say in it, because a nurse maybe was there last week, but the aide just spent 2 hours with the family and is seeing something different that the nurse didn't see. So it's really important to us. And the work that the hospice team is, so we develop a plan of care, which is based on what the wishes of the patient is, and we go around that. We manage pain and symptoms, and we attend to the emotional, psychosocial, and spiritual aspects of dying and caregiving, and we teach the family how to provide care. We often find families want to do the care, they're used to doing the care, they've been caring for their loved ones, maybe experiencing illness, so we'll teach them how to provide that care, especially because we can't be there 24-7, although we're available 24-7. And then we advocate for the patient family, like I said, just whatever, you know, they'll make arrangements for families and do whatever, you know, if there's no plans for what the funeral arrangement is or whatever, they will help put that all in place and work all of that out. And then we provide bereavement care and counseling. So we do that a few different ways. You could call any one of our offices listed on the back, if you can get one of these, but I'll leave this up here, and say you want to talk to someone about the loss of someone you loved. It could have been someone in our hospice program or not. It could have been, this is available to the community. So anyone in the community who's experienced a loss, whether they were on hospice or not on hospice, on our hospice, but a different hospice, or that they, it was a loss recent or 20 years ago, and you're just, you know, this has, grief has no timeline. We're available to help people. That's a community outreach we have. So we provide hospice wherever anyone calls home. So at the Hanson Center, assisted living facilities, we have contract with nursing homes. We also train that staff to be able to provide the care that we need as far as working together with us and collaborating. Majority of our patients are at home. That's where they want to be. We honor that. We love that people want to be at their home, and we'll provide all the support we can for that to happen. At the hospital, like I mentioned, and again, wherever they call home. And who pays? So I mentioned this, Medicare is pretty much paying for hospice care, as well as Medicaid and then insurance and health maintenance organizations. private pays, sometimes it's a combination. We, as a nonprofit, do raise funds so that if there was someone who was uninsured or underinsured, or there was something we wanted to provide that wasn't covered under the hospice benefit, we could look at those funds to support that. And then mission criteria. So pretty much, a doctor has to say, looking at this person, we don't know when someone's going to die, that if their disease continued the way it was going, that they would have 6 months or less. Now, we see people outlive that diagnosis often. Sometimes our nurses will get together and the team, and they'll say, I think this person's imminent, and that person will outlive, you know, and they'll be on a hospice for a year. And then sometimes they'll think someone has a long time, and there's a sudden turn, and there's a surprise. So we don't know that. You know, I brought up the example, like President Carter, he's been on hospice for almost a year and a half now. And that's pretty amazing. And that's really a testament to what hospice care is. And his children, especially his son, speaks out a lot about hospice care and what a gift it's been. Because he's able to hear all the honoring that's going on with him. And, you know, he's doing pretty well, actually. He just turned 99 in October, and I hope he makes it to 100. So.
Wow.
I really hope he makes it to 100. I hope he does that, because he's really an example now of what hospice can be as a public figure. And so they have to live in our service area, and our service area is all of Erie County, all of Cass County, Van Buren County, the whole county, and then the southwest corner of Allegan County. And we have offices and teams in all those locations. And then they have to agree to accept the services. So if they have someone who speaks on their behalf, they would agree. And then we say you have to forego other medical conditions. We would get in trouble if we were giving, you know, hospice care and the person was pursuing, like, cardiology surgery for their heart condition, which was the reason they were in hospice to begin with. So pretty much any other thing that they wanted to go to the doctor for, anything that would never be limited. I think that I've heard in the past there was a myth or belief that if you went on hospice, they took away all your medications. We do not do that. We do not. And even dialysis, which is a life-giving treatment, they automatically, you know, they'll be nine visits approved, but we always, for every situation, even radiation, if that's providing comfort, we evaluate every individual person, and if there's comfort involved, we're going to pay for it. It's just not even a question of that. And then myths. So a lot of people think that it's mainly for cancer, and only like 18% of our patients that we're taking care of right now are actually cancer patients. We have a lot of patients that have Alzheimer's, as well as heart disease and lung disease, kidney disease, so Parkinson's, we deal with many different situations. So I think there's a misconception about that. And that's another thing that I'm part of this Hospice Action Network, which is a national level. Congress wrote hospice as a 6-month benefit, but that was, you know, 40 years ago when it was mostly for cancer. Now all these other diseases are, people are sicker longer, and we want to extend the benefit. And we can do that. We just had a patient pass away this week who was on hospice for 4 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so it's amazing. And the support and love that person got for 4 years, and his wife was very peaceful about the situation, and it was a really good death, actually.
There's an art to it.
Yeah.
The art of dying.
And so when someone does pass, you know, the team will all talk about, like, who in the family will need some more reaching out, more support. Because we don't go anywhere once a person has passed. We're still around. We continue our grief support for 13 months, and then we're lucky because we have some more grief support available as well. And so we say, you can't tell really when someone would benefit from hospice, but if they're going to the doctor over and over or having emergency situations, they're calling their doctor, it's overwhelming for their loved ones to provide care, that's a reason you might want to call us just to do an evaluation and provide some information. Pretty much some of the reasons. And so this is something like, so we see often the emergency room will call us and say, there's a patient that needs hospice. And so we get them home, and we get them situated, and they pass in 2 days. And that is tragedy for us, because we weren't able to provide the gifts of hospice to them. And it really breaks the heart of our team, because we know that we can. And nationwide, 25% of people who go on hospice are on 7 days or less, so less than a week. And then 50%, this is national statistics, is 2 weeks or less. 50% of all people. So we really, our hope is that people will reach out earlier. And you know, it's never too early to learn about what's available. And then we, you know, like I mentioned, although it's a 6-month benefit, we can continue to certify a patient as long as they meet all the criteria. And they want us to. And who can refer? So a lot of people, like I thought in my situation before I knew better, that a doctor would have to make that phone call to refer a person to hospice. That is not true. Anyone can call. It's anybody at all can call for themselves. We get those phone calls a lot. Their loved one, their daughter, their brother, their sister. And so we always will go out. If somebody calls us and says, I think I want to talk about hospice, we'll send a patient's LPN out who will talk about all the details. And then if they decide that hospice makes sense for them, then our nurse will follow up and do a full assessment and include our doctor in that evaluation. So, and it's, we do them, oh, some families we might follow for months before they say, yeah, now it's time, I think it's time now. Because, you know, maybe they are doing badly and then they get better. So we're always, you know, we'll do follow-up calls or, you know, let them just call us. And then bereavement care. So I did mention that this is one of the things I've given out. We do a lot of different groups that they're doing. Like we're doing a Mother's Day honor and remembrance. There's walking groups and there's painting groups at Lori's place and there's support groups. So again, just remember if there's anyone you know in the community or yourself that's experiencing grief from loss, we're available as a community service.
And we have a grief share group in our church that meets regularly gives them an opportunity to talk and comfort each other.
Yeah,
so
that's good.
I think there'd probably some overlap with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fabulous. And then, so palliative care. So palliative care is pretty much pain and symptom management. And hospice does include palliative care, but sometimes people will be like, they don't have a terminal illness, but they're going through a lot of pain and suffering for a condition. So that is what palliative care steps in and does. It is like a specialist who comes and helps their specialist or their doctor just provide some more symptom and pain management. Yes.
So you don't have to have a terminal illness to receive palliative care from hospice.
Right.
Because I've known some.
Hospice, yeah, it's palliative care. It's a different program. Yeah.
I've known some people who have chronic conditions, and they're not like, you know, on the process of dying, but they just have constant pain of this or that.
Right.
You could provide help with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I did mention this last night that, you know, before COVID, we had a huge team that was out there in the community doing palliative care, but then we lost some providers, and then they weren't allowed to go see people because of COVID, and they were doing. So right now we have a team that's in the hospital, and then they also are at the Marie Yeager Cancer Center, and we're in the process of recruiting more providers. So it's really, we're focused on cancer right now, only for palliative care, but for everything else, we're for everything right now. So it's just the situation we're in, which frustrates me, but I can't afford to pay the doctors what they need, personally, or I would. And so it's a consultative services. This is the only one where a doctor would have to write an order and send it to us. But everything else, we don't need anyone to provide an order for us. Any questions? I've talked about a lot, and I talk fast. I'm originally from New York. Any questions or comments or any experiences, good, bad, or yes?
Well, when my parents were alive and they were around and able, one of the things that they did was they had therapy dogs, and they worked with you and went into the various places and like at like across the street over there,
yes.
And then in other locations. So with their they trained their dogs to be therapy dogs.
Yes.
So.
Good. Did your parents have therapy dogs, or they visited by? That's
no, I'm sorry.
They were the volunteers.
They were volunteers, and they were taking
they
were taking their dogs
that's
over
so
there to help.
That's so great.
Help with
so
the various
great.
Patients and et cetera.
Yeah, that's really important. People miss their pets when they're and it really makes a huge difference.
And it was amazing that one of their dogs actually knew when one of the patients was about to pass away within hours, and he would just sit there and just be very quiet and allow the patient was conscious to pet him, for hours until.
There's a book about a cat that, at a nursing home that I forget the name, and my friend gave it to me, and it's this cat knew and would just sit on, like, lay on the bed of this person. Did you have a question?
No, I just wanted to say what you say about your organization is very good. We just went through that with Margaret about 3 months ago.
Oh,
and,
I'm sorry for your
loss. Care was very good.
Good.
And our family was very happy.
I'd say the same thing. Back in the 90s, we had Hill Hospice 3 times in our home. They were wonderful. They helped us so many things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I've worked in healthcare for like 25 years, and I've been doing this for 8 years, and I feel like it's a gift every single day. And I think our team feels that way, too. They're a bunch of angels, so it's really a privilege to do this work, and it's thank you very much.
Oh, you got two questions there and another one back there.
Yeah.
Sandy and I have only been married about 9 years.
Okay.
She has 5 children, I have 4.
Okay.
Our youngest ones are both nurses.
Oh, nice.
Excuse me. And they both have been surgical care nurses. Mm-hmm. And in the last few months, they both have changed. They're now hospice nurses. Mm-hmm. My daughter, Krista Schultz, is here.
Yeah.
Her daughter is in Florida.
Okay.
And they both, it's interesting how they've done that. And they said they really enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's a whole different world than being in the hospital doing things and taking care of people. It's nice. So anyway, and plus, my wife, when she had gotten ill and was going to die, we had a hospice at the house, and then we never went across the street.
Yeah.
They were wonderful.
Good. We had a lot of nurses that were ER nurses, and are the whole pace of ER and crazy busyness. And when they become a hospice nurse, they're really kind of in charge. They're on their own, and seeing the patients, of course, consulting with the whole team, but they're really very, very close to their patients, and it's a prolonged. Lots of questions.
Okay. My husband was on hospice too before he passed away. But I hate to say this, but there were some bad things that went on for him. They gave him some kind of medication and it almost killed him on its own. And I called him and was talking to him, and they said, "Well, give him some more of this." And I said, "Are you crazy?" And then one came there. The one nurse wasn't available, but normally came. And someone else came, and she says, "Why, they got them on an awful lot of painkiller." So she knocked it down, and then what happened next? He was in terrible pain.
Yeah. It's hard to predict, what is that perfect level of, too much or not enough,
Well, he was doing fine on what was he was on. I didn't get why they wanted to knock it down.
I can't speak to that particular situation.
My husband fell out of the bed that night after she was there.
Yeah.
And then he was in such pain, I got my sons that lived real close to come. They couldn't touch him. He just all sat there and had to call somebody to please come and see what's going on.
Did that help when they came?
Yeah, we got it back in bed, and he got more of his pain med back, and he didn't last too much longer, but I'm sorry you might say that. Yeah, I wasn't.
Yes,
we had a great nurse towards the end, but when he was looking like he was going to pass away, she came and sat, but he just didn't go, so I
went
home. We had all the family there. And
You know, one of our nurses says that sometimes the body, you know, late and end of life is fighting, and it's full-time job is to try to stay out of pain, and there's all this. This is what one of our nurses says, and she says that, you know, that sometimes, you know, the pain medication, if it's the right one or whatever, will let the body relax and let the spirit relax, and that I can't answer that. It's a mystery. It's a mystery. Did you have a question or a comment? I know there's one back there. Yes.
Well, my sister was passed away just a couple of years ago, and she had really bad lungs for a long time and stuff, and she went on hospice for, and that care was just wonderful, and they made her, and she was cognitive and able to, and she was included in all the decisions, and she it was a really good thing, and they took care of her family, and they started organizing this and getting the doctors and the medicines and everything and physical therapy and the pastor and everybody there. It was really amazing. You did it just exactly as you said. And her family had a pretty good network of being able to take care of her stuff, but she wanted to pass away at home, and that was attainable and everything. And as it progressed, its your organization was so dynamic, and it just went so smoothly, and it helped the family a lot and everything. And I just wanted to thank you. Everything worked so smoothly. Yes, there was problems, but they were taken care of.
We're not perfect, but
you addressed them. We had to both take her to her doctor, and then her doctor had to give her doctor the form that she's going to be in hospice care now. And anytime we had a problem, instead of going to the doctor, we called hospice, and they took care of it and addressed it. And she had some wounds on her leg. They had to come several days in a row to take care of her. They helped her with bathing and everything else. It was, I thank you.
Get another 5 minutes, maybe. I know you've got another half a dozen slides.
Yeah,
maybe we can skim through those, and then she can stay afterwards and talk to some more people.
So we also have different programs besides hospice. One of them is house calls, which is primary care in the home. So this is a person that is not hospice eligible, just someone who's homebound and can't get out anymore. We have a program where it's just like it sounds, house calls. We go in and we provide care in the home.
So that's like old-fashioned doctors making house calls.
House calls, exactly. Yes.
Nice.
It's really nice. They arrange people's medications. We'll have them delivered, so they're on the phone. It's just like a primary care doctor. Grief support and education, I mentioned that. We also have Lori's Place, which most people have heard of Lori's Place. It's been around 15 years, they do a tremendous job, which is, we're so lucky to have that. And then we have community partnerships with Area Agency and Agent, ACE, Marie Ager, home care agencies, and such. Lori's Place. So this was Lori's Place, is named for Dr. Lori Schultz, who passed away very young. Her children really suffered, and her loved ones and friends went out and looked at different grief support programs throughout the country and came back and created Lori's Place, which is pretty extraordinary. They have an operating budget of like $400,000 a year, and it's all donations they work on. You know, it's amazing. And so that's why they provide everything at never a cost to anyone. And then some people sometimes think it's just for children, but we have groups for every kind of thing. And once again, don't ever have to have been in hospice, could have had a loss recent or many years ago, and just are looking for support and some help. They also are in 50 different schools, middle schools and high schools, and elementary, providing monthly support groups for children that need to talk to somebody. And, of course, that's they do that through the social worker in the school or the counselors. And so they do that. They also do community education. Like if you ever wanted them to come in and talk to your grief group, they could do that. And we do lots of different education. They do it specifically. And then advanced care planning. So we're big on this. You know, I've given you a booklet, and it's, you know, we always get these different booklets from our doctor, and we take them home, and they don't do anything with them. But we have tried to make it simple, like what is acceptable for you, what's not acceptable. And we just feel like it's really important that your family hears this from your mouth, so it's a conversation. So for that reason, we have 80 trained facilitators who will go out in the community and help people do this if they want help, or we can do a workshop anywhere you would like us to do one and help people walk through doing this. You know, I was asking our advanced care planner, you asked me last night if a family was saying, no, doctor, don't do that, we don't want that. She told me, I asked her the question on a text, she said, if somebody, like the family is having differing opinions, that causes a big problem. That's why it's really important there's a document, because everyone has to agree. And I don't know about you, but my family did not agree on things from another to end of life or situation.
And so for those advanced care directives, just because a lot of stuff we've talked about over the past weeks, you know, like a will or whatever, you need an attorney to fill out and file or notarize. It looks like this is just kind of a general form, and all you need is a witness to it, and then make some photocopies to give out to whoever you designate as your advocate.
Right.
It doesn't need an attorney.
No lawyers.
You can just fill it out and have it witnessed, and you don't even need it notarized, right?
No.
Just a witness, and then it's valid. So it's a good thing to have.
Yeah, and you know, you would just need to bring this to your doctor or hospital, make sure your advocates have a copy. And you know, but I love this because we really are down to earth talking about what's meaningful to me. And I love this page. It asks, is religion or spirituality important to me? I belong to this faith community. I would like spiritual support. Please call whoever. And what are things that bring me comfort? What do I want nearby in a room? Who do I want there? Who do I not want there? And I want this, you know, this is what, if I'm nearing death in the room, I would like the room to be like this. You know, who's there? Like, you know, are your pets on your bed? Or what, you know, what's important to you? What music or whatever? So I really love this document. It's amazing. They did a great job on it. And then 20% of our patients are veterans, and like I mentioned, we have a We Honor Veterans program, so we have trained volunteers who really have that. They are veterans, and they meet with veterans because they have special needs at the end of life. Maybe they've dealt with things they've never talked about, and they want to talk about it. So that's something we're really empowered to do. We, you know, have a special booklet for our families just talking all about, like, how we're caring for veterans, where they can get additional support, just so we can know everything about the veteran, so we can make sure we're doing the work with the VA to ensure that we're coordinating care and that they're getting all the benefits that they deserve. And volunteers. We're always looking for volunteers. You can do as little or as much as you want. So we have friendly pet visits, group projects. Some just come in and maybe stuff envelopes, or we have people put flowers together. Every week, they put flowers together and take out to all of our patients. And so we have a lot available. It's just always a little bit of something for everyone, I think. And then pet peace of mind. We're only one of two hospices that we're part of a national pet peace of mind program, and it started we were one of the first involved. So it's a national program where we get some funding to provide like additional support for a patient in hospice who just can't take care of their pet independently and need some help with bathing or whatever. And then we also, if they don't have a plan for what's going to happen with their pet, we help alleviate that worry from our person. So it's really important to us. We think, you know, pets are part of the family, most people. We have a partnership with a hospice in Kenya. That's a very poor hospice, and we have been providing, since 2019, some actually before 2019, 2017, providing additional training and support to them. We had a team go over, help teach them things, and we now meet virtually. I think we're working on having another team go out there again, or over there. And then the American Hospital Association, every year they honor hospices that are doing innovative care. And in 2020, they awarded us, right here in your community, one of two hospices that got a national award for what we do. So that's pretty great. And then the We Honor Veterans, we are level 5. That's part of the National Hospice Program, national program. And so that's the highest level you can be. We do a lot of work to make sure we stay at that level, and we can also train other hospices who want to enact this veterans program. And then we're your partner in care. Wherever you are, you can ask for us by name if anyone suggests that hospice care might be something. It doesn't matter where you are, what insurance you have, and a physician referral is not required for anything other than palliative care. That's the end of me. So any questions or comments?
So, thank you guys for coming. Thank you, Angela. She'll stick around for a few minutes if anybody wants to chat. And just a reminder, next week, I don't have any more special guest speakers. Next week, we're going to go through that other booklet. We'll talk a little bit more about end-of-life issues, and we'll wrap it up, and then we'll take a break for the summer from the Bible study, okay? So, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. If you are able, you may stay seated. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day.
Thank you.